I'd like to very pleased to welcome Benjamin Lovitz from IQC, so very local to us at PI, and yeah, he's going to tell us a bit about entangled subspaces and generic local state discrimination, please.
Thanks, Michael. Yeah, so thanks for having me. I'll be speaking today mostly about the second half of this title. I'll mention that this is a joint work with Nathaniel Johnston up at Mount Allison University. And you can find the slides for this talk at my website, benjaminlovitz.com. Just scroll down to the presentations tab and you can get it there. So we'll be speaking mostly about the second half of this title, trying to figure out what are the most useful entangled states to share to facilitate local state discrimination, and how common are they? So first I'm going to start with something completely different, a little bit of algebraic geometry to get us off the starting block. So algebraic geometry is a natural generalization of linear algebra, similar to many topics in geometry are natural generalizations of linear algebra. So the fundamental objects of linear algebra are linear spaces. And there are two ways to represent a linear space. One is as the span of a set of basis vectors. And this is known as a parametric representation of your linear space, parameterized by the coefficients that you would put in front of your basis vectors. The second way to do it is called an implicit representation of your subspace, which is to represent that subspace as the kernel of a linear map. And every linear subspace is equal to the kernel of a linear map. This is a fact from linear algebra. I've put a quick and dirty proof here for over the complex numbers, but it holds more generally over any field. We have our linear subspace S, and let S perp be the orthogonal complement of S, and then choose a basis for S perp. And S will then be the kernel of your matrix T, where T is the complex conjugates of your basis stacked on top of each other. So in the notation of algebraic geometry, we refer to this, the kernel of T, as the variety cut out by the linear functionals V1 through VK. V stands for variety. And we also say that this is the common zero locus of the linear functionals V1 through VK. So what algebraic geometry does is to generalize this to the common zero locus of any polynomials. They don't have to be necessarily linear. And these are the fundamental objects of study in algebraic geometry, affine varieties. So just as some bookkeeping here, we define a quasi-affine variety to be the set difference of two affine varieties. And even more general than that, a constructible set is any finite union of quasi-affine varieties. There are even more general notions in projective space of quasi-projective varieties, for example. And you'll see that in our paper on archive under the same title. We actually do everything in projective notation, but I've put everything in CN here just to make it more concrete. A morphism of algebraic varieties. So the morphisms of linear spaces are linear maps between linear spaces. So naturally, a morphism of algebraic varieties is a polynomial map between algebraic varieties. So just like there's a notion of dimension of a linear space, there's a notion of dimension of an algebraic variety, and even more generally of a constructible set. So let's let X be a constructible set that forms a cone over C. We say a linear subspace trivially intersects X if its only intersection with X is the zero vector. Okay, so what I'm gonna say, there's a version of this theorem for when X doesn't form a cone, but all we'll need is the case when X is a cone and has this nice connection to linear subspaces through the origin. So the theorem is this, that the dimension of a variety, so just like the dimension of a linear space counts the number of free parameters in your linear space, right? It's the number of basis vectors, the number of coefficients in front of your basis vectors that you're free to pick. In the same way, the dimension of a variety is meant to pick the number of free variables that you're allowed to pick in your variety. And so it's a theorem that this notion is equivalent to the following. So the dimension of your constructible set that forms a cone turns out to be the same as the dimension of its closure. This is just the Euclidean closure of X. Turns out that the Euclidean closure of a constructible set forms an affine variety. So the dimension of a constructible set is equal to the dimension of its closure. And it can be characterized as follows. So if you put the dimension of X on the number line, then for any n greater than dimension of X, almost all linear subspaces of dimension big N minus little n, in other words, of codimension little n, trivially intersect X. And in fact, they trivially intersect the closure of X. And for any number n less than the dimension of X, almost all linear subspaces of that codimension non-trivially intersect X. We can say something even stronger for the closure of X on the left-hand side, which is that actually all linear subspaces of a small enough codimension non-trivially intersect the closure of X. So let's get an idea for what's going on here when X is a linear subspace. So on the left-hand side here, right, just under the standard notion of dimension, so that the notion of dimension of an algebraic variety agrees with the notion of dimension of a linear space when that variety forms a linear space. So a linear subspace is closed. So the stronger statement down below here should hold. So the statement on the left here is just a standard fact in linear algebra that if you take two linear spaces and the sum of their dimensions is greater than the dimension of the ambient space, then they must have non-trivial intersection. So this is all that's going on the left side. And then on the right, so clearly there exists a linear subspace of dimension equal to the codimension of X that trivially intersects it, right? Just take its orthogonal complement. That trivially intersects X. And it turns out that almost all linear subspaces of that dimension trivially intersect X. So what do I mean by almost all? I'll make a few statements about almost all elements of a set today. And what I mean is actually a very strong notion of almost all is that there exists, so you put some structure of an algebraic variety on your set. And the statement is that there exists a Zariski open dense subset of that set that satisfies whatever property we're talking about. So in this case, we have that there exists a Zariski open dense subset of the Grassmannian of big N minus little n linear subspaces that trivially intersect the closure of X. So what is a Zariski open dense subset? By definition, this is just the set complement of an affine variety, or a projective variety can also be defined in that way. So I'll just mention, for example, Zariski open dense subsets are full measure with respect to any standard measure. So these are really meant to be describe massive sets. Are there any questions so far? Okay.
I'll ask a question. Do you mind saying why, like maybe just give a hint as to why we're working in this kind of more generalized framework of varieties rather than just linear spaces? What is this buying for us?
We can describe more sets. So there are sets that are algebraic varieties, but they're not linear subspaces. And for example, in this talk, we'll be talking about algebraic varieties. So for example, the dimension of a variety, just like the dimension of a linear subspace, can be computed. So if you have an algebraic variety and you know what its dimension, its dimension corresponds to some physical quantity, you can compute that.
Okay, and what will we be, sorry, what will we be using this BridgeR kind of sets to do?
What will we be using affine varieties to do?
I mean, you were saying that you can describe more sets, right? So there's the richer kind of class of sets that you can describe. And what are we doing with that?
Oh, so we're going to run into an algebraic variety that's not necessarily a linear space. And we're just in the course of, it's the what I'll call the SLOCC image or the SLOCC orbit of a state forms an algebraic variety. But it's not a linear space, obviously.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay. So let's do some quantum information theory. A standard setting in non-local quantum computation is that you have two parties or two or more parties, Alice and Bob, that wish to perform some task on an input state, psi n. And I've left it very general here. Maybe they have full information about psi n or partial information, or it's a classical state, who knows. But anyway, they want to perform some task on an input state where A is the Hilbert space, A is the Hilbert space given to Alice. It's a finite dimensional Hilbert space. And B is the Hilbert space given to Bob. And they're allowed to use pre-shared entanglement in the form of what I'll call a resource state phi that might live in a different space than a tensor B. It's its own register. And I'll denote the local registers of phi by CR, one given to Alice and one given to Bob. So R is the resource register given to each of them. And a question with a well-known answer is, what is the most useful state phi for them to share? Well, before we even know what the task is, we already can say that the most useful state is the canonical maximally entangled state, right? This state phi. How do we know this? Because, well, if they needed some other state, then they could just convert phi into that state by LOCC. So phi won't always be the maximally entangled state in this talk. Just to clarify any confusion, just for this slide, phi will be this maximally entangled state that I've chosen here. There's a caveat to this that it does take some resources to convert the maximally entangled state into some other state that you might find useful for your particular task. But we're not going to be concerned with the number of rounds in your LOCC channel or anything like that. It's just kind of a yes, no question. Like, can you execute the task or can you not by LOCC? This maximally entangled state is the best state possible to do it. So the natural next step is to look at more than two parties and ask what are the most useful states for say Alice, Bob, and Charlie to share. They have three local parties, Alice, Bob, and Charlie. What's the most useful states for them to share to execute non-local tasks? Well, the question becomes much more difficult in this case. So far from the existence of a single state that can be converted into any other by LOCC, already for three qubits, an infinite number of pure states are required to reach every other state by LOCC. And for four qubits, actually a full measure set of states are required. So this isn't a very satisfying answer because, we can't go to experimentalists and ask them to prepare, say, maybe someone might dream up a protocol or there might be, a family of protocols in the future, each of one needing, one of these full measure set of pure states. So we need to be able to potentially make every single one of these states. This isn't very satisfying. So a natural alternative to considering LOCC convertibility for determining the most useful states is to determine the most useful states for particular fundamental tasks that seem to pop up in a lot of different places. So today we'll be considering just that question for local unambiguous state discrimination. So we'll be defining a notion of the usefulness of a state for phi for LUSD. We'll determine how useful a state is. We'll determine what are the most useful states for LUSD, and how common are they? So I'll be sticking to the multi-party setting for the majority of the talk. And actually just three parties, Alice, Bob, and Charlie. So let's define local and ambiguous state discrimination. So we say a set of states is locally unambiguously discriminable if there exists an LOCC measurement with n plus one outcomes, one, two, three, up to n, the number of states, and then a question mark outcome, that when applied to psi I, outputs either I or question mark with non-zero probability to output I. So what is it doing? On input psi I, the measurement will either correctly identify that the input was indeed the ith state, or we allow it to have some probability to say, I don't know. And what we require is that there is some non-zero probability that it correctly outputs I. And we also require that it never errs. It'll never accidentally say that the input was J when in fact it was psi I. So there's a nice characterization of when a set of states is locally discriminable. This is if and only if there exist product pure states, mu one through mu n, that sort of pick out the psi j's in this way. So let's unpack this statement. First here, I'm using this notation seg for the set of product states. This is the Segre variety. It turns out that the set of pure product states forms a variety, and it's known as the Segre variety. So the statement is that there exist these pure states such that the inner product of mu I with psi j is non-zero if and only if I equals j. And this is a result due to Shuffles in 2004. This is not hard to prove. Let's see a sketch of the proof. So if psi 1 through psi n is locally discriminable, then, well, it's discriminable by a LOCC measurement, so it's discriminable by a separable measurement, right? So there exist these separable positive operators, m1 through mn, and then m question mark, that do the job we want, right? If you receive psi I, the probability of outputting j is non-zero if and only if, or sorry, this should be greater than zero in particular, greater than zero if and only if I equals j. Right, so the mu i's are basically doing the same job here. So you can see the connections going on. All right, but we have these m's and we need to construct the mu's. And for each mj, you just choose mu j to be any product pure state in the image of mj. And it turns out that it'll satisfy this property here. Conversely, I won't write down the details, but you have these product state mu's. If you take their, you know, if you take the rank one projectors associated to them, you know, that almost looks like a measurement, and it has this local structure to it. And you have to kind of be a little bit clever to turn that into an LOCC measurement, doing the job that you want to do. But essentially, this is the idea. Are there any questions so far? Okay. So next, so I just told you about local and ambiguous state discrimination. Now we're going to get into local and ambiguous state discrimination with a resource state, when the parties are allowed to use pre-shared entanglement in the form of a resource state to implement their measurement. And there's also a nice characterization of when a set of states is locally and ambiguously discriminable with a resource state, just as there was without a resource state. So in order to state that characterization, we need this SLOCC image to define this. So this is also known as the downward closure with respect to SLOCC. I've called it the SLOCC image for whatever reason. So the SLOCC image of a state phi in the resource space, in the space ABC, so there are two spaces going on, is the, denoted as follows, is a set of pure states mu in ABC that can be obtained from phi by LOCC with non-zero probability. So the S in SLOCC stands for stochastic or probabilistic. And there's a really nice characterization of the SLOCC image due to Dura, Vidal, and Serac in 2000 that will be very useful for us. So the SLOCC image of phi in ABC is precisely the set of states that you can get to, that you can get from phi by applying local linear maps between the correct systems, right? So there, it's the set of states for which, you know, there exists these local linear maps, MA and B and MC, where MA, for example, is from CR to A. So you get into the right space. That you can apply to phi to get your state. So the way I've defined it here, actually, the SLOCC image, or you know, the way I've stated in this fact, the SLOCC image actually isn't a physical set of states, right? This consists of unnormalized unit vector, sorry, unnormalized vectors as well as unit vectors. So I'm going to stick. This is going to be like my mathematical definition of the SLOCC image of phi. It'll be useful for us because it forms a cone. So we'll be able to apply that algebraic geometry theorem that I mentioned before. Again, the better way to do this is using projective notation. Pure states are exactly points in projective space. But just so we can avoid that abstraction, I've introduced this ambiguity here. All right, so for example, the SLOCC image of any bipartite Schmidt rank R state. So now I'm looking at just A tensor B, the SLOCC image in A tensor B, is the set of pure states of Schmidt rank at most R. Another example is the SLOCC image of a trivial resource state. So what can you get to with no resource state at all? Well, you can just produce the only pure states you can make are the product states. Right, the Segre variety. Okay, so now let's look at LUSD with a resource state. So mathematically, it's really easy to characterize LUSD with a resource state. So by definition, a set of n states is locally discriminable with resource state phi if the corresponding tensor products with phi, given here, are locally discriminable, where now the local systems are the, you know, A tensor, the portion of phi given to Alice, right? So it's the whole thing here is the local system. So Alice is allowed to perform local operations on that whole system here. You know, there's a little bit of ambiguity here because there should be some swap operators. There's some swap operators behind the scenes going on here that I haven't written. Because here, these states are in, you know, A, B, C, tensor, CR, 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 and I've kind of moved things around here so I can group them nicely. Okay. So if you just kind of scratch your head and think about it a bit, you can see that mathematically, this is how we can describe being locally discriminable with a resource state. All right, so I'll mention in this LOCC protocol here, I haven't drawn any classical channels between Charlie and Alice. And this is because, just to emphasize that we really don't care about the number of rounds happening in our LOCC measurement, right? Charlie can send a classical message to Bob, who can send a classical message to Alice. That's without loss of generality here, because we really don't care about the number of rounds. Are there any questions about this? All right. So, you know, already from the definition, you can see that we can just apply Scheffel's theorem here and get a characterization of local state discrimination with a resource state. So this is the result of Bandyopadhyay, Halder, and Nathanson in 2016. That if we let S be our set of states and phi be our resource state, the following statements are equivalent. So first, S is locally discriminable with phi. Second, just the definition of that statement. Third is Scheffel's lemma applied to this, to this setting. So there exists product states where the product partition is now, right, IA tensor CR is one, it's only product with respect to a tripartite system where the local systems are A tensor CR, B tensor CR, and C tensor CR, right? So there exist these product states in the bigger space that pick out your psi J tensor phis. And finally, statement four, this is the cliture that connects us to the SLOCZ image, is that there exists mu one through mu n in the SLOCZ image of phi in ABC, such that the standard bilinear form between mu I and psi j is non-zero if and only if I equals j. So this is my attempt to write the standard bilinear form in Dirac notation. I apologize for it. As soon as you want to do something fancy with Dirac notation, you can't. This is kind of what I don't like about it. But anyway. I hope that this is clear enough. I'm just taking the transpose instead of the conjugate transpose of mu I. So unfortunately, we need to take the transpose instead of the conjugate transpose when a resource state is introduced. So here's a sketch of the proof. 1, 2, and 3 are clearly equivalent. We've already discussed, right? 1 and 2 are equivalent by definition. 2 and 3 are equivalent by the Scheffel's lemma we just saw. It remains to show that 3 and 4 are equivalent. So to prove that 3 implies 4, we have the gammas and we want to construct the mu's. And so note that if we choose mu I to be as follows, and we take the transpose of mu I and we hit it with psi j, will precisely get the inner product of gamma I with psi j tensor phi, right? There's a psi j missing from here. And if we put it in there, right, that's just corresponds to just putting it in there, basically. Where we need the transpose here, why the transpose is coming into play is because we really want mu I to be in the SLOCZ image of phi. And that's the key. So if we took the conjugate transpose here, it would only be in the SLOCZ image of the complex conjugate of phi. And it's just not as nice to write, but we could have replaced the transpose here. We could have instead of taking the transpose of mu I, we could have taken the complex conjugate of phi in the SLOCZ image. So it remains, you know, you have to verify that this indeed is in the SLOCZ image of phi. You do it by using that characterization of Dirac-Vidal and Seurat of the SLOCZ image. And you know that the SLOCZ image is the states obtainable from phi by local linear maps, right? So you have to verify that this is equal to local linear maps applied to phi, which isn't difficult to do. You just move things around, right? The gammas are already product. You can kind of see what's going on. So conversely, we have the mu's now and we want to construct the gammas. So we have these mu's elements of the SLOCZ image of phi that have non-zero inner product bilinear, you know, bilinear pairing with psi j if and only if I equals j. And so by that Dirac-Vidal and Seurat fact, we have that mu I is equal to local linear maps applied to phi. And so we need to construct our gamma i's. It turns out that these are if we let gamma I be the vectorization of these linear maps, actually the complex conjugate of the vectorizations, then it does the job that we want it to do. So the vectorization here is defined as follows on standard basis vectors. How does it do the job? Its inner product with psi j tensor phi is precisely the bilinear pairing of mu I with psi j, which satisfies the properties that we want, right? It's non-zero if and only if I equals j. I'm kind of rushing through this, or going quickly through this anyway. But it's the kind of thing that's just better to work it out on your own and make sure that everything, all the matrices push around in the right way and everything's in the right spaces. So I'll pause here and ask if there's any questions. Great. Okay, so now that we've gone through what's known about local state discrimination, we're going to start doing something new. So our goal is to determine how useful a state is for local state discrimination. A natural way to characterize this is by how many states can be locally discriminated with resource state phi, right? You have your non-local parties, they're allowed to implement an LOCC measurement and use phi as a resource state. How many states can they locally discriminate? Well, of course, this question depends on the particular set of states to be discriminated. Already for a trivial resource state, it depends, right? N orthogonal product states are always locally discriminable, but N identical states never are. So the question isn't well posed as stated, but it turns out that to have a really nice answer in the generic setting. So I'm going to define these two quantities, n max and n max tilde. N max being the maximum number for which almost all n states, almost all sets of n states, are locally discriminable with phi. So n max is the number for which generically phi is completely useful for local state discrimination. The converse number is n max tilde. This is the smallest number for which, for any greater number than n max tilde, almost all n states are not locally discriminable with phi. So n max tilde is the number for which, at the point at which phi becomes generically completely useless for local state discrimination. You see that, again, I'm using this statement almost all, which I've shoved to the background exactly what that means. But again, it's the existence of a Zariski open dense subset of the objects that we're talking about. So in this case, it would be n tuples of states in this multi-party Hilbert space. Okay, so, and then in between nmax and nmax tilde, there's this question mark area, right? Where maybe half of the states are locally discriminable with phi and half of them aren't. So our main result is, however, that actually these two quantities for any resource state phi, these two quantities are equal and they can be characterized as the dimension of the SLOCC image of phi, or if you like, its closure. So, the SLOCC image of phi, turns out this set forms a constructible set, actually, and it's a cone. So the reason why it forms a constructible set is, this is a result of Chevalier, that the image of a variety under a morphism of algebraic varieties forms a constructible set. And it's not difficult to see that the SLOCC image of phi is just that. It's the image of a variety under a morphism of algebraic varieties. So it is a constructible set. So we could just take its dimension proper without the closure. It's equal to the dimension of its closure, but it's not really standard to take the dimension of a constructible set. It's out there, but it's not as common. So that's why I've written the closure there. Because the closure, the Euclidean closure of any constructible set is a variety. Okay, so we have all the tools we need to prove this result. Here's our result restated, and we're going to prove one direction of the result. So recall that, so I'm going to let X be the SLOCC image of phi and D be the dimension of its closure. And I'm going to let little a, little b, and little c be the local, be the dimensions of big A, big B, and big C, right? These guys here. So under those definitions, we have our, I've restated our algebraic geometry theorem here that we saw in the beginning of the talk as lemma one. So what it says is that, you know, for any number less than the dimension of X, almost all linear subspaces of that codimension, dimension ABC minus N, non-trivially intersect X. And for any number equal to D or greater than D, almost all linear subspaces of that codimension trivially intersect the closure of X. And then lemma two here is our characterization, well, Bandyopadhyay, Halder, and Nathanson's rather characterization of local state discrimination with a resource state. And this says, so it says that psi one through psi n are locally discriminable with phi, if and only if there exists elements of the SLOCC image X that pick out the psi j's, right, in this way. All right, so I'll prove one direction of the theorem that n max tilde is less than or equal to d. In other words, almost all sets of d plus one pure states are not locally discriminable with phi. Okay, the converse would be to prove that almost all sets of d pure states are locally discriminable with phi. But we'll only prove the first direction here. Okay, so by lemma one, almost all linear subspaces of dimension ABC minus D trivially intersect X. So suppose we take a set of states, psi one through psi D, and suppose they're linearly independent. Then the orthogonal complement of their span, where I'm taking the orthogonal complement with respect to the bilinear pairing here, the orthogonal complement of their span has dimension ABC minus D. So what this means is that almost all sets of states that I could have picked, for almost all sets of states that I could have picked, the orthogonal complement of their span, you know, will be one of these linear subspaces that trivially intersect X. Right? We'll satisfy this property. So I'm shoving something under the rug here with this statement, in that, you know, our two notions of almost all, we have almost all linear subspaces and almost all sets of states, both corresponding to Zariski open dense subsets, that they play well with each other in this way. And I'll keep that under the rug. But suffice it to say that they do. And so the claim is that for any such set of states, psi one through psi d, that satisfies this property, almost all of them do, any choice of psi d plus one, for any choice of psi d plus one, the corresponding set of states, psi one through psi d plus one, is not locally discriminable with phi. This should be, this should say any there, not n. And this follows from lemma two. So, and in particular, it follows from the fact that there cannot exist a mu d plus one that does the job here, that satisfies these two properties, because, so number one, mu d plus one has to be in X, and number two, mu d plus one has to be in the orthogonal complement of the span of psi one through psi d, right? By this property, the bilinear pairing of mu d plus one with any psi j for j less than d plus one has to be zero. But that intersection is zero. There's nothing in that intersection. So there can't exist any mu d plus one. So as a result, this set is not locally discriminable with phi. So what we've done is we've constructed we've proven that almost all sets of d plus one states are not locally discriminable with phi. Right, because for almost all sets of d states, you can add any you know, corresponding D plus one state, and it won't, the resulting set won't be locally discriminable with phi. All right, so let's look at some corollaries here. So first, we'll talk about the usefulness of a particular phi, and then next we'll talk about what are the most useful resource states and how common are they. So the first two examples come right from something we've seen before about what is the SLOCC image of particular, you know, particular examples of SLOCC images. So in the bipartite setting, the SLOCC image of a Schmidt rank R state is the set of Schmidt rank at most R states. In fact, that set already forms a variety, and it has the following dimension. So we know that, you know, the number of states that can be locally discriminated with phi generically for any Schmidt rank R bipartite state is as follows. And for any greater number, almost all sets of that number of states, you know, can't be discriminated with phi. Another example is the trivial resource state. So for a non-existent resource state, the SLOCC image of, you know, is the set of product states, the Segre variety. And the dimension of that set is also known as follows. And this is a result of Walgate and Scott in 2008, actually. They were the first to characterize the generic number, the number of generic pure states that can be locally discriminated, period, you know, without a resource state. And tremendous credit to them for this result. It's a really nice result. And you know, stumbling across that paper is exactly what led to this whole inquiry into SLOCC, you know, local state discrimination with a resource state. So another example where we know what the dimension of the SLOCC image of phi is the GHZ state. So it turns out that the dimension of the SLOCC image of the GHZ state is often equal to R times the dimension of the Segre variety. And at least is lower bounded by this quantity. Whenever this makes sense, right? I haven't written in something here, which is that, you know, this quantity, so a set of linearly dependent states you can show is never unambiguously discriminable. Local restrictions or not. So the maximum number of states that can be locally or not locally discriminated is upper bounded by the dimension of the whole space, which in this case is A times B times C. So a caveat to this inequality is that it holds when it makes sense, right? When it's not greater than A times B times C. So there's actually a conjecturally complete set of cases, set of exceptions to equality not holding here, given in the paper of Abbo, Ottaviani, and Peterson. With, you know, the corresponding dimensions in those cases, in those exceptional cases. So these authors, by the way, they weren't interested in the SLOCC image of the GHZ state. It turns out that, I guess in that it's the SLOCC image of the GHZ state. They're interested in this set because it has applications. It's a well-studied set in algebraic complexity theory and related fields. It's called the Arth-Secant variety, or at least the closure is called the Arth-Secant variety to the Segre variety. Which is well studied in algebraic complexity theory. And that's why they were interested in this set. So we kind of get for free, based on their hard work, a corollary for the usefulness of the GHZ state. So what are the most useful states for generic LUSD? And how useful are they? And how common are they? So at least when the resource space and the ABC space are equal, we have an answer to this question. Or at least some kind of answer. So in this case, it turns out that the SLOC, the closure of the SLOCC image of phi is equal to the closure of the SLOCC orbit of phi. So this is defined to be the set of states obtainable from phi by LOCC with non-zero probability, from which you can get back to phi by SLOCC once again. And it turns out that these have a similarly have a nice characterization, just like the SLOCC image did. It can be characterized as the set of states obtainable from phi by local invertible maps. So in other words, it's the orbit of the product general linear group on phi. Okay, so it's nice for us that these two closures agree in this case, because now we have an algebraic group acting on phi. We just have a group orbit now. Whereas the SLOCC image, I'm not quite sure how to deal with it. Group orbits are, algebraic groups are well studied and their orbits are well studied. So we can just kind of plug and play results from, linear algebraic groups. Let's see. So I won't go into this proposition in terrible detail, but what it says is that if you have an algebraic group acting on an algebraic variety, almost all elements of that variety maximize the dimension of the of the orbit closure. So almost all elements of your variety maximize the dimension of the orbit closure. And so what this means is that, we have a dimension of an orbit closure here. So in particular, almost all states in almost all resource states maximize the dimension of the orbit closure and hence are maximally useful for generic LUSD in CR tensor CR tensor CR. I can't really decide if this is surprising or not, but I'll argue that it is because it's to my own benefit. So in the LOCC picture, we saw that, I didn't tell you about it, but in the LOCC picture, most states are somehow useless for LOCC conversion in that they are all isolated. So what this means is that for almost all states in multi-party space, you can't get to anywhere from them by LOCC, except by local unitary operations. So these are the trivial LOCC operations. So basically, they're not powerful for LOCC conversion. All you can do is the trivial operations. But what this corollary says is that, most states are not useful for LOCC conversions, but most states are useful, maximally useful for generic LUSD. So who knows what's happening here? And if you do know, please tell me, or have an argument in the other direction. So let's look at a particular example, almost all states maximize the generic number of states that you can discriminate with them. But can we come up with explicit examples of such states? How many states can you discriminate with them? This is a table giving some of those results. So this is just, I've just dug this up from the literature, Gorkraus and Wallach and Gore and Wallach, and some references therein. Where I've gotten these examples from. So I'm considering m qubits here. So we've been considering three systems, in other words, m equals three, but I've kind of extrapolated that to more systems. Everything we've seen today can be generalized quite easily to more than three systems and resource states that don't, you know, all resource states for which the local dimensions of the resource state are not all equal to R. They can be different. So anyway, this is for M qubits. Okay, so in the first column here, I have how many qubits we have. In the second column, I have the maximum number of generic pure states that can be locally discriminated with a generic phi. In other words, a maximally useful phi. And then the third column, I have an example of such a maximally useful state phi. And why is this stuff present in the literature? It's it's a group orbit. And these actually have been studied for quantum information reasons, looking for states with a trivial stabilizer, because these are precisely the states that are isolated. Trivial stabilizer under this local invertibles, this group of local invertibles. So it's kind of funny, like almost like exactly what makes a state useless for local state for LOCC conversion, in other words, isolated, is what makes it useful for LUSD in a way. Because states with trivial stabilizer maximize the orbit, the dimension of the orbit. Okay, so let's see. I'm not going to go into this table in any more depth. I'd like to make a hard cut over to entangled subspaces, so I have 5 minutes to go through that. But maybe I'll pause here and ask if there are any questions about LUSD in general, or. Okay. So I'll briefly review our work on entangled subspaces in this paper. So these are informally linear subspaces of ABC for which every element is entangled in some way. So entangled subspaces are useful. They're related to unextendable product bases in that the orthogonal complement of an unextendable product basis contains no product states. So is entangled in that way, in that every element is not product. Entangled subspaces have also been used in quantum tomography and quantum error correction and entanglement witnesses. So the particular entangled subspaces that we'll look at today, there are many that have been studied, or several at least, are the following, generalizations of the following subspaces that have been studied in the literature. The Parthasarathi determined the maximum dimension of a subspace containing no product states. And if you remember our algebraic geometry theorem that I mentioned, it's not mine, it's a common result in algebraic geometry, gives this result immediately, right? It's just, what's the maximum dimension of a linear subspace that avoids your set of product states, your Segre variety? It's just the codimension of your variety, right? But this was first observed by Parthasarathi in 2004. And Cubitt, Montanaro, and Winter determine the maximum dimension of a subspace of A tensor B in bipartite space without any states of Schmidt rank at most R. In other words, containing only states of Schmidt rank greater than R, as follows. Again, this is just the codimension of the corresponding variety, the variety that you're trying to avoid. So also by the algebraic geometry theorem, we know that these subspaces are generic, right? Almost all linear subspaces of the right dimension will avoid your variety. But it seems like it's been difficult to actually explicitly construct nice examples of these subspaces. Even though they're all over the place, it's been hard to construct them. So Bahad explicitly constructed a linear subspace of this form, of the maximal dimension. And Cuban, Montanaro, and Winter again found explicit constructions of these subspaces. So what we do is generalize this notion in sort of to higher multi-party entanglement in sort of a natural way. Admittedly, it's not so like operationally motivated, our definition of these higher multi-party entangled subspaces. So I look at it more of as kind of like a proof of concept. Like we're kind of observing that, you know, there's this one algebraic geometry theorem that applies to everything. And here's this natural generalization of these previously studied entangled subspaces. And we can just characterize, you know, the maximum dimension of such an entangled subspace immediately from this theorem. The tensor rank of a state is the minimum number of product states, which can be put in superposition to create that state. And we refer to its closure, we denote its closure by sigma r. This is known as the rth secant variety to the Segre variety. It turns out that this set is the same as the closure of the image, the SLOCC image of the GHZ state. And this is where that this tensor rank interpretation is where this SLOCC image has found a lot of interest in algebraic complexity theory. States of tensor rank at most r are related to the complexity of matrix multiplication, for example, can be phrased as sort of a tensor rank question. So we define an R entangled subspace to be one that has trivial intersection with sigma R. So sort of annoyingly, well, we've defined it in this way to avoid the closure. Alternatively, you could define it to avoid the set itself, but then we wouldn't be able to use the algebraic geometry theorem to determine exactly what the maximum dimension of such a subspace is. So what have we done? We've determined the maximum dimension of an R entangled subspace. This is just ABC minus the dimension of sigma R, right? I can't really claim that we've done this. We're just plugging and playing the theorem. We've also explicitly constructed some examples of these higher multi-party entangled subspaces. For example, we've constructed two entangled subspaces of 3-qubit space and two entangled subspaces of 4-qubit space. We've also derived analogous results for bosonic and fermionic systems. So determine their dimensions and also matching the known results by Pathasarathy and Cuban, Montanaro, and Winter in the case, I guess you'd call these distinguishable particles, these spaces. So we were able to kind of adapt their explicit constructions of entangled subspaces in the distinguishable particle case to entangled subspaces of bosonic and fermionic systems, you know, matching the bipartite bosonic and fermionic entangled subspaces of maximal dimension, and then explicitly also explicitly constructing, you know, kind of the first entangled subspaces of multi-party space, multi-party bosonic or fermionic space, containing no product states in that space. And then we've also applied our results to entanglement witnesses. It's kind of been proven time and again that for different sorts of entanglement, the maximum dimension of an entangled subspace is precisely the maximum number of negative eigenvalues of an entanglement witness, where you measure entanglement in the same way with these two quantities. So we've kind of tried to make an umbrella statement that contains all of these. So finally, you know, people don't have to keep relating the dimension of different sorts of entangled subspaces to the, you know, number of negative eigenvalues of the corresponding entanglement witness. Also just applied our results on the maximum dimension of our entangled subspaces to this case. Okay, so that's all I have for you today. I had a lot of fun putting this talk together, and I hope you got something out of it. So thanks a lot for listening.
Great. Let's all thank Benjamin for the really interesting talk. And we can open up for questions. So I maybe have a kind of more general question about the whole an ambiguous state discrimination problem. So if I'm right, in your definition, you had, you just needed to have P greater than zero. That, so if you have state I, then you'll output I with some probability that's just greater than zero, or you can say, I don't know, or it can say, I don't know. That's right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
what if you wanted P to be like not exponentially small in like the number of qubits or something? If you wanted it to be like polynomially small, can anything be, because if I was an experimentalist, I'd not only want P to be greater than zero, but I want it to be like something that I could actually see in practice.
Yeah, definitely. I think that this is studied. I'm not up to date with it though. I agree that realistically that's what you'd actually want to determine. If there's some minuscule probability of getting it right, who really cares? But no, we didn't look at that.
Yeah, and maybe so you concentrate on this one task here, but these methods you've talked about seem quite kind of general. So do you think there's hope of applying them to other specific tasks with this kind of framework?
I certainly hope so. I'm interested to see if other tasks have been studied in this way. I'm sure they have. I just don't know about them. Like finding what are the most useful states for kind of fundamental tasks, and what are good tasks to look at? What are the useful ones? You know, the kind of the intersection of useful but also fundamental enough and have a clean enough description that you can study them in this way.
Thanks. I'll give one final chance for other questions. Okay, well, if not, let's all thank Benjamin again.